So thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure to be visiting the Institute. So today I want to tell you about a recent paper that I'm very excited about. This is joint work with some collaborators at Penn State, Eugenio Bianchi, Anuradha Gupta, and Satya Satyaprakash, and just appeared at the end of last year. It's on the archive if you'd like to check it out. So the motivation for the work starts from this characterization that we often give of black holes, that they're the simplest possible objects in gravity. Black hole in equilibrium is completely characterized by just two parameters, by its total mass and by its spin. And yet in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, Hawking realized that black holes radiate. And so they must have a temperature and hence an entropy. And you turn to the calculation of that entropy and you find an astronomically large entropy. So which is it? Are black holes the simplest objects or the most complex? And this is an interesting question, one that that I think it may have phenomenological consequences. And that's what I'm particularly excited about. And in particular, the phenomenological consequences that I want to tell you about are independent of your favorite theory of quantum gravity. Essentially, the calculation that I want to show you is semi-classical, and so it's robust to changing the details of your quantum theory. So the first observation is a very simple one, which is that if we fix the mass, then as the black hole spins up, the entropy actually decreases. So I'm going to express things today in terms of the dimensionless spin parameter. So that's just the angular momentum of the black hole rescaled so that it's dimensionless. And this Kerr parameter takes values in the range 0 to 1. And as you know well, the prediction for the entropy is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And it can be written in terms of this dimensionless spin parameter as here. So as you go from a non-rotating black hole to an extremal one, the entropy actually falls by a factor of 2. And so what I want to unpack for you is that this may be a handle to get a phenomenological test of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. I don't know of any proposed test that really is a test of the gravitational Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So if anyone in the audience does, I would love to hear about it. And that's why I'm so excited about this as a potential, is that it's really the first in-principle test that I know of. Of course, there are caveats and details, and I'll get into them, but I don't even know of other in-principle tests. So a quick outline for the talk. The first step in the argument is to introduce what we call the black hole spin ensemble. So this is the conditional probability of finding a particular spin if you fix the mass of a black hole. So I want to go through the derivation of that ensemble for you, and that'll be the first part of the talk. Many of the people in this audience are experts in gravitational waves, but I want to tell you a little bit about the 10 black hole binary measurements that have been made at LIGO, and how our predictions compare to these LIGO measurements. And then finally, in the last part of the talk, I want to argue the whole idea of the talk is going to be based on the idea that black holes can form in microcanonical equilibrium. Classical stellar collapse models do not allow you to form in microcanonical equilibrium. So I want to give you an example of a formation mechanism where you can form a black hole in microcanonical equilibrium, to give you a sort of proof of principle that it makes sense to talk about these black holes. So that's the plan for the talk. And let me start just by telling you the result of what this black hole spin ensemble is, and then we'll go into the derivation. So objects with entropy, we know that we usually think of this as counting a number of microstates. So if I think of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy as determining the number of microstates, I get this exponential relationship. And what we started to think about was that this determines this conditional probability. So if I fix the mass of the black hole and ask for a collection, ensemble of black holes of that mass, how should the spins be distributed? Then you can think of that as the total number of states with the mass and spin fixed divided by the total number of states with just the mass fixed. And so here this factor of a squared is a measure factor, given that we're thinking of the angular momentum as a vector distributed through three space. Then if I integrate over magnitudes, I just get this measure factor. So this is the conditional probability distribution. And it has a striking feature, which is that it highly prefers black holes of low spin. So what the plot shows is the Kerr parameter along the x-axis, and then this probability distribution along the y for a variety of fixed masses. So if you have a black hole that's just 2 times the Planck mass, then you can get a wide variety of spins. But if you increase the mass, this distribution becomes highly, highly peaked near small spin. Again, this is under the assumption that we're not biasing the population at all. So this is a microcanonical distribution. We spread over the whole mass surface.
So you're not thinking of astrophysical collapse.
That's right. I'm not thinking of stellar collapse.
It's some other.
That's right. That's exactly right. Stellar collapse has this history that the star starts with some angular momentum, and the matter is going to continue to have that angular momentum as it collapses. And so you're going to have large spins. So I'll tell you a model that I'm thinking of towards the end of the talk. So if you use this distribution to predict the expectation value of the spin, you find that it's the ratio of the Planck mass to the mass of the black hole. And so you can calculate what this means for a solar mass black hole. And these are truly tiny spins, right? As a dimensionless Kerr parameter, we're talking about effectively zero spin as your expectation value. So this is due to that observation we just made a second ago, that the entropy decreases as you increase the spin, right? So there are far more states with low spin than there are states with high spin. So that we're just formalizing that observation.
So you're thinking of a mechanism for creating black holes,
Yeah, so the analogy would be with a gas in a box, right? So why do we think microcanonical equilibrium is a good description? Well, it's because the interactions of the gas molecules are sufficiently rich, sufficiently chaotic, that you spread out over the whole energy surface.
So here what replaces the average interaction?
I know you want to jump there, but can we pause till the, I would promise I want to talk about that too. I just want to tell you where this comes from first. So this black hole spin ensemble, it has some roots in old work of Eugenio's, but it also just appeared last year in this this paper that's open access, if you want to look at some of our motivations there. So I want to give you a derivation of that ensemble. I want to give you a quantum mechanical derivation. And this is where the fact that we're relatively insensitive to the details of your quantum gravity theory comes in. It's going to be a semi-classical derivation of that conditional probability I was showing you. So the first assumption is that we want to think about asymptotically flat black holes. So we're going to imagine that we have a Poincaré symmetry in the asymptotic regime. And so these black holes can be characterized by the two quantum numbers that you would expect from that symmetry, the total energy, which I'm going to write as this mass operator, and the total angular momentum, which I'll take as having that form. So the third label of these quantum states is going to be alpha. And the idea is that it just enumerates an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space that has fixed mass and spin. Okay. So I'm not going to assume that we have further symmetries that allow me to label all those with quantum numbers. It may be a chaotic evolution, but I'm just going to give you some basis in that Hilbert space. But these two quantum numbers allow us to impose a decomposition on the Hilbert space. So I can divide it into sectors, where I add up Hilbert spaces with fixed mass over all masses, and that gives me the total Hilbert space. And then in turn, I can decompose the Hilbert space of fixed mass into the spin sectors, okay, the angular momentum sectors. So the idea would be that a rotating black hole can be characterized as a maxly mixed state over these alpha labels, right? So I'm going to think of it as rotating and of fixed mass. So M and J are fixed, but I have to maximally mix over the alpha part of the state. Yeah.
So you're presuming M is discrete, I guess, right?
I'm intentionally leaving the notation a little bit ambiguous because you may prefer a theory of quantum gravity where it's discrete, or you may prefer one where it's a continuous spectrum.
Yeah, but then you got infinite dimensional Hilbert space, right?
Yes. Yes. So I'm happy to take it to be discrete. All right, so that's the density matrix for a black hole of fixed mass M and fixed spin J. Now I'd like to pick out the microcanonical distribution within that space. So the microcanonical distribution is going to be the one where all I fix is the mass. So again, I'll take the maximally mixed state. So this time we have to sum over the J labels as well. And this prefactor should really be a sum over all of these instead of just the dimension of both fixed. And the nice observation is that this density matrix for the microcanonical ensemble can be written as a sum of the density matrices with the mass and spin fixed. And so it's a mixture of these states. And what we'd like to do is understand the what's mixing. What's the probability for given mass and spin? So a quick observation is just that if I go between the previous slide, I need to cancel this factor and replace it by this factor. So these coefficients are just the ratio of the dimension of the Hilbert space at fixed spin and the dimension of the Hilbert space summed over all spins. Okay. So the semi-classical calculation that I'd like to do is to calculate this dimension. So semi-classics is ideal for this because this is what makes it robust to the details of the quantum gravity calculation. I'm really looking at an asymptotic regime where the mass of the black hole is much greater than the Planck mass. And so I can do nice semi-classical approximation to this. So we introduced the canonical partition function. I say we, but this was already done back in the 70s. Here, SE is the Euclidean action. And we can do this path integral in the semi-classical limit, this large mass limit, and you get these results. You get that the dimension of the Hilbert space at fixed spin is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for a spinning black hole with this power here, which is due to the graviton loops. This is interesting for Seth and Bianca. This is where these show up in this calculation. And of course, the dominant contribution is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy.
So this is assuming no other matter in the loops. It's all just gravity and gravitons?
Yes.
How would that exponent change if you did that?
So this exponent changes as you do all sorts of things. If you do a modified theory of gravity, the exponent changes. If you change the matter content, it changes. But these all show up in the logarithmic corrections. So the probability distribution I'm talking about is instant.
Yes,
yeah, exactly. This is really relevant because I'm going to focus throughout the whole talk on the microcanonical distribution. But you might prefer to think about a canonical distribution. It's a bit subtle, right, because the heat capacity of the black hole is negative. But as long as we're talking about timescales that are much shorter than the lifetime of the black hole, canonical should be approximately right. But all that's going to adjust is the logarithmic correction.
That's just the coefficient.
So this is the result of the semi-classical calculation. And again, here these are the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And so this coefficient PM of J that I was introducing in the limit of large mass reproduces exactly that distribution I showed you on the first slide. It gives you this conditional probability. So this is the derivation of that black hole spin ensemble. Any other questions at this point? Okay. So with that background, I want to tell you a little bit about the current status of the LIGO measurements. And I want to use this black hole spin ensemble to give predictions about populations of black holes. So exactly the sort of thing that Laurent was asking about, how do these microcanonical black holes differ from stellar collapse models? Okay. So let's think about a black hole binary merger and gravitational wave observation as a sort of in-out process. So the in states are going to be the mass of one of the black holes and its spin, the mass of the second black hole and its spin, and the orbital angular momentum of the two black holes around each other. So that's our in state. We expect that the end state will be another black hole. They'll merge and form another black hole of mass M final and final spin JF. And of course, they'll emit gravitational waves in the process. So this is the model for the gravitational wave signal. I'm just repeating the definition of the dimensionless spin parameter here, mostly just so you can look at the axes of this plot. So one way to visualize the results of the LIGO measurements is to put chi effective, which I'll tell you what it is in a moment, on the x-axis, and the final spin of the black hole on the y-axis. So chi effective is called the effective spin parameter of the merger. It's this mass-weighted average of the two spins of the constituent black holes projected along the orbital angular momentum. So the reason that LIGO focuses on this is that this parameter affects the phase of the gravitational wave, and LIGO is most sensitive to the phase. So at the moment, this is by far the easiest parameter to extract from the gravitational wave signal. It shows up at the lowest post-Newtonian order in the wave. They also hope at some point to measure what's called the chi p, or the precession parameter. And if you had a precession parameter that was substantive, you would be able to extract the individual spins of the black holes. But at the moment, it's hard to do that. So all you can do is extract this combination. And this combination is interesting because you see the gravitational wave measurements cluster around zero chi effective. So this is a little bit degenerate, because you could have that the two spins of the black holes are anti-aligned, and that's why you have a small chi effective. You could have that the black hole spins are, for some reason, in the orbital plane, and so they're perpendicular to the orbital angular momentum. Or you could have that the individual spins are small. So there's a degeneracy here that nobody knows how to break at the moment. So you have to take everything I tell you with that caveat in mind. I'm viewing the anti-aligned case and the orbital plane case as sort of special circumstances. And so I'm going to interpret small chi effective as meaning small spins for the moment. But that has this big caveat.
This is a tangential question, but it's not just clustered at zero. There's a bias for chi positive. Does anybody make any fuss over that? Like, I would have expected it to be distributed positive negative for chi, but it's not.
Yeah. And so when we started this work, there were only the five measurements reported. And so it was all right here. And we were like, huh. And then the newer ones came out. And I agree, they're biased towards positive chi effective. So the LIGO scientists are great. You know, they're hard-nosed experimentalists. So they say, the data's going to tell me. You try and ask them to infer anything from this. And they just say, no, the data will tell. So they're waiting for more statistics here. But there are some, in the gravitational wave catalog, there are some nice posteriors where you can look at whether various astrophysical models are being preferred or not. And slowly, this chi effective bias is having an effect on those posteriors.
So they are looking good.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, it's almost illegible, but as we're getting up to higher numbers of events, it's hard to label them. But the shapes of these tell you the various events. OK, everybody clear on chi effective? This object is interesting. It's the furthest away black hole that's been measured also. So it seems to be somewhat of an exception in both its high effective and its distance, luminosity distance. Okay, so let's do what Laurent was hoping for, and let's compare it to astrophysical models. So the first astrophysical model that people consider a lot is what they call an aligned configuration. So this would be binaries that were formed in a common envelope evolution. So you have some big cloud of dust that gets blown off. The black hole, the cloud is rotating. So there's a stellar explosion. There's this big cloud. It's rotating, and black holes form, or stars form in that, eventually can collapse. And so their spins can be aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the pair. So this is called the aligned model. So what we did was we took the best numerical relativity simulations that the LIGO team uses and ran 500 candidates with an aligned configuration and allowed them to merge and looked at their chi effective AF parameter space. So the orange cloud of dots are those 500 simulations. The dots themselves are colored. You can see some are darker and some are lighter. And the coloring has to do with the mass ratio here. So the darker colors, the darkest color is a mass ratio of 1. And the lightest colors are more severe mass ratios. These distribution, we put in M1 equals 10 and M2 equals 30 solar masses. And so this is the distribution. The gradient is from 1 to 3 for the mass ratio. The reason for that choice is just that the LIGO observations seem to be in that range of mass ratios. As Rob Mann was pointing out, the distribution is skewed here. But it still doesn't agree very well with this aligned distribution. So it's a funny thing that's happening. The data is starting to prefer an aligned model over, I'll show you, an isotropic model, but in a weird way where a lot of the points don't fall on the model at all. So that's the situation. So second model is what's also what's called dynamical evolution sometimes. So this is a model where you have a dense globular cluster of stars, and you get black holes forming within that globular cluster, but they're formed, you know, by severe collisions or explosions within that dynamical environment. And so the spins of the two black holes are randomly aligned. So you imagine that the constituents are randomly aligned with respect to each other and with respect to the orbital angular momentum. So for this, you get, again, from numerical relativity simulations, you get this cloud of purple dots. So this is the isotropic. So let's compare the prediction of this microcanonical equilibrium population that we're imagining. So this has two pieces to it. Let me focus on this first piece, and then I'll tell you the second piece. The first piece says that we form two of these microcanonical black holes. And according to the probability distribution, they each have zero spin. So you form a capture of two of them in each of the constituents with zero spin, and they have some orbital angular momentum. So a really fun numerical relativity fact, which should be a challenge to all of us in the room, I think, is that for mass ratio of 1, numerical simulations extremely robustly produce that the final spin is 0.69. I've never seen an analytic argument for this, but that, we should do it. You know, two-body problem in general relativity, what's the final spin if you have zero spin constituents?
And that's robust to the amount of orbital.
So it has to be a nearly circular orbit. It can't be a complete, like you could imagine one way to violate this would be a head-on collision, right? As long as it's nearly circular and you can characterize how much of a violation it is, it comes out at this value. So this red set here is again 500 draws from this population, and the result. And again, it's hard to see the gradient here, but the lightest part of the gradient's at the bottom, and the mass ratio one's at the top here. So that the smearing here is due to the mass ratio. So it's also a function of the mass ratio. So that's
which configuration?
That's this configuration.
Is it 1G,
1G? First generation, first generation. So we imagine there's a mechanism for producing microcanonical black holes. This is a first generation merger.
So, I mean, you know, unless these things are just a few Planck losses, they're all going to be zero spin.
Yes.
So in this model, you're anticipating that astrophysical things, however they're born, obey this so effectively, they all have zero spin. Is that the logic?
That's the logic. That's right.
So we expect this to apply to astrophysical guys, because astrophysical guys are so heavy, they basically all have zero spin when they are folded, which is what first generation.
That's exactly
that's
right.
The logic.
That's the logic. We have to be a little careful. You'll notice I tend to distinguish astrophysical from stellar collapse because, as we said a moment ago, stellar collapse, we know they tend to form with a high spin.
Yeah.
So astrophysical I take to mean any mechanism, and here I'm imagining the mechanism is microcanonical.
But these guys presumably would be born primordially and just start eating things.
Yes.
And get big.
Yes.
So I'm confused about your red line, because you just said that AF is 0.69, but now you have a line.
Yes. The red line is a function of the mass parameter. So the robust conclusion is that for many initial conditions, if you have equal mass black holes, then you get 0.69.
So this is like
this is the mass ratio dependence. So then just to better understand our model, we also allowed for a first generation, second generation merger, where you imagine that some point in their history, this pair merged and formed a black hole with spin 0.69. And then you allow the 0.69 to merge with another first generation black hole. And you get the blue dots of this 1G, 2G distribution.
And are you imagining the 2G guy is isotropically distributed in any old spin relative to the other?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So,
sorry, maybe I missed something. If you're only positing things drawn from the ensemble, how are you defining generation?
Generation is a function of time. So when they're first formed, they all form like this. But we imagine as the black holes evolve, they can merge and form a second generation black hole with spin.
So once they're drawn from your initial distribution, is that the distribution of like these ordinary black holes?
Yep. Then we look at these as a new population and draw one from each.
So why not do 2G, 2G?
Oh, we did. We just didn't. So the question is one of timescales, and nobody has a really good handle on this. But the thought was that 2G, 2G, you probably have to wait too long to get to it. Yes. But nobody has a good handle on those parameters. That's certainly something one could explore at great length.
They could be old.
They could be extremely old.
They could be older than age.
Yes. Yeah. If it came from about. Yeah. Absolutely. So we just cut it off at some point.
So you have a population of sort of astrophysical black holes whose spin starts at zero, but in order to be detected, their mass is going to have to be stellar masses like the other liable objects. And I can see, since you're explicitly excluding the stellar collapse origin black holes, why should there be any reason why black holes you're discussing are any of the stellar mass rather than 10 to the 30 stellar masses, or 10 to the 10 stellar masses,
like AGN. Sure. If you'll allow me, I'll delay the answer to that. I have a very direct answer to that. Okay, so I just want to summarize the LIGO observations and where we're at. So I showed you on the very first slide our black hole spin ensemble. And it gives results like this, results highly peaked at low spins. We just saw the two most common astrophysical models, this common envelope, which gives you aligned distribution. So the aligned distribution tends to look flat in spin, because you can imagine they're always aligned with each other, so it's just about the magnitude of the spin. So the non-informative prior is just to take flat distribution there. And then for the isotropic model, of course, you get the measure factor, the a squared from your measure, and so you get a distribution that looks like this. So the question, the phenomenological or empirical question is, can we distinguish these amongst the actual black hole events? So that's what we're looking for.
Which one is the, I can't read the labels.
Yeah, the labels are a bit hard to understand. 1D is just because it's aligned, so you're just distributing this, the magnitude of the spin.
So it's a 1D.
Yeah, it's just uniform across spins. The 3D,
points in any direction.
Yeah, 3D, it's a vector, and so it points isotropically any direction. And so I get a measure term, right? I get a squared dA. And so that's where this comes from. And this is our microcanonical equilibrium.
And sorry, your astrophysical ensemble means what? Like four frame collapse or something?
I broke my own rule, I'm sorry. This was an older slide, I should have modified this. I just meant these two common models that people talk about, the aligned and isotropic models. That's all I meant.
So not formed from, like formed.
Not formed in equilibrium.
Astronomers, astrophysicists.
Thank you for clarifying that. So, and then just to summarize and compare these three distributions, so again, here's the aligned model, the one we started with, here's the isotropic model, and here's these microcanonical. And we were really surprised and delighted that the microcanonical does as well as it does. It's striking. So another thing that we see numerically that I think begs for an analytic explanation is this envelope here. So there's lots of interesting things to do. Okay. So in particular, you might worry that some of the black holes out there are formed according to this common envelope, some are formed in globular clusters, and some are in thermal equilibrium, in microcanonical equilibrium. So are we able to distinguish populations that are mixed? Right? This is a very a question for the LIGO observers directly. So let me define four populations of black holes. The first population, I'll call it M1, is 90% aligned, and 10% are first generation black hole. Second population, 90% aligned, 10% 1G, 2G. And so on down this list, isotropic NRs, isotropic and 1G, 2G. And so what we did is we ran these statistical tests to check whether we can distinguish between a pure aligned population where all 100% are aligned, and this M1 population where 90% are aligned but 10% are microcanonical. The Anderson-Darling and Kolmogorov-Smirnov tests, the way the p-values work is if the p-value is 1, the two populations are indistinguishable. So you can see that we do badly on isotropic versus a 10% mixture of 1G, 2G. That's not too surprising. If you look at these plots, these look very similar, right? Or if you look at the cumulatives here, the 1G, 2G is the blue curve, and the isotropic is the dark dashed, and these two cumulatives are very close to each other. On the other hand, for an aligned population and a mixture of 1G, 1Gs, we do extremely well. You could easily distinguish even a 10% fraction of our microcanonical black holes. So the reason for that is also pretty clear. The microcanonical ones are really peaked on that 0.69 value that we talked about. Okay, so from an empirical standpoint, it looks like this is reasonable. It's something you could actually look for. So I want to get to these questions that everybody was asking of how are you imagining that you get a black hole in microcanonical equilibrium? And the answer was anticipated. Oh, well, let me just review this the stellar collapse issue. So when is a population of black holes well described by the microcanonical ensemble? Well, certainly not when it came from stellar collapse. There are at least three reasons for this. As I already anticipated, the initial matter distribution has an angular momentum, and we expect the black hole to just have an angular momentum from that initial angular momentum. It's called a natal spin. So stellar collapse leads to natal spins, and you don't expect them to be in equilibrium. A second issue is that angular momentum exchanges are not efficient. And so remember, the reason that we were thinking of microcanonical equilibrium, as Laurent was anticipating, is that we have rich enough interactions that we really explore the microcanonical surface. But it turns out that this is just hard to do for black holes. So you wouldn't expect to really explore that whole surface in a stellar collapse scenario. And finally, in a dense environment, accretion can drive spin up. So if you have an accretion disk on your black hole, it can just spin the black hole up. So you probably know that there are several black holes that have been measured with spin parameters close to one. Andy Strominger gave a talk at Berkeley while I was a grad student there. And he was trying to argue that extremal black holes were really relevant for astrophysics because they'd measured 0.98. I couldn't believe that argument, but it does show that high spin parameters are available. Okay, so we don't expect stellar collapse to be in microcanonical equilibrium. So the idea is to go to a bright primordial black hole. So one of the questions that was asked was, what kind of masses do you expect? So if we think of primordial black holes that are formed in the QCD phase transition, then there's a beautiful estimate you can do. So you just take the density of the matter as the mass divided by the Schwarzschild radius cube and the standard Schwarzschild radius, and you can solve for the mass. So mass in terms of the density, and it goes like 1 to the square root. So if we take the QCD phase transition, the density is a couple of pions per Compton wavelength. So you plug that in and you get this density. And if you plug that density into this formula, you hit 25 solar masses. I couldn't believe this calculation when I first, it's right in the LIGO band. So this is a back of the envelope calculation, and who knows how seriously to take it. But there have been nice lattice QCD simulations since. And they find similar results. So at the QCD phase transition, they find black holes forming in the 1 to 100 solar mass range. So it's very close to the LIGO band.
So in other words, the claim is at QCD phase transition, we're forming 25 solar mass black holes primarily?
Yes.
That's surprising.
It still doesn't address why the momentum should be.
Good.
Yeah.
I agree. So let me say just two more.
In that equation, you're assuming that everything is quantized. So
yeah.
Formal 25.
Yeah, I agree.
You need to have a collective motion. So
yeah, this is purely dimensional analysis. The QCD calculations, they really do consider a fluid. So it's a numerical simulation in the regime they can reach. But I find the papers impressive. I'm sorry, I don't have the citation right here. But anybody that's interested.
So why not earlier the electroweak transition or something? I mean, why the QCD?
Purely for this mass range. I'm just choosing that to get.
It'll be a lot smaller for this early, right? That's what people usually think of for primordial guys.
But as you mentioned, we could imagine that they form earlier, they're smaller, and then they evolve to the mass range that we're in. I don't want to overcommit myself to one particular thing. I'm just trying to give you a model in which you could imagine microcanonical equilibrium happening. I'm not trying to say it's the only model.
And the argument is made that the QCD phase transition pressure, the nature of the phase transition makes the pressure drop perhaps all the way to zero, at which point gravitational collapse is no longer impeded by radiation pressure. So normal density perturbations don't form more black holes because they're not big enough to overcome the radiation pressure in the early universe. The QCD phase transition might be an exception to that, but it's very controversial.
So normally the pressure electroweak or earlier just too big.
It's too big.
Radiation pressure.
Yeah. So upon you then need a perturbation of order 1, so the collapse immediately on the horizon, which is not unlikely.
Like the QCD pitch addition may be a much smaller density calculation and perhaps during the pressure of the space at the distribution. It's something to do with the crossover nature of the pitch addition that escapes the EU, but it was more recently than the.
Yeah, so you're anticipating me exactly.
For singling this out.
There is a reason why the QCD transition was particularly interesting in this phenomenon, and indeed it's been known for a long time. Is the horizon of NASA at that time is a water slowly mass. So at least that coincidence has been marked upon.
Absolutely. So this, I agree completely. Not at all new to me.
How do you estimate the density of primordial black hole?
Ah, good. So that's analysis that we have not done. But this is a primordial mechanism, so you could follow a lot of the previous papers on primordial black hole number densities. So the work of
sometimes they come out huge.
They can come out large, yes.
You should expect many more of those that still.
Yes. So, but I think there's a lot of knobs to turn on these models, and people can come out with lots of answers. And so, I personally don't have a strong line on that. So.
To be very interested, this kind of scenario, you want these more difficult platforms to be a candidate dark matter.
Yeah.
So they are most of the density, because this hierarchy merging that is being appealed to is also only likely to work. Black holes are most of the matter in the universe, otherwise other parts of the nation will dominate over generational instincts. So you have to somehow be in the regime where most of the matter in the universe is black, and that's what we're talking about black holes.
Right, but my question is why you're not orders of magnitude past that situation, you just overclosing things.
I don't think there's a definitive answer to that question at the moment. I wasn't planning to go into this much detail on this, but just to show you a plot, this is one of the pieces of evidence for this drop in pressure at the QCD phase transition. So these are, again, these lattice QCD numerics, and they look at the equation of state and the sound speed as a function of the ratio of the horizon mass to the solar mass, and you see this abrupt drop in this tens of solar mass range. So this is part of the evidence why the QCD phase transition is particularly interesting. The vertical axis is it depends on the curve, but it's showing the equation of state, for example, dropping down. So this numerics does not support this claim that it drops all the way to zero. It supports the claim it comes down to some finite, much smaller value, but it enhances production. Is the idea. You don't. The pressure drops, and so it's easier to collapse. Okay. So, first of all, their primordial black holes can fall in this mass range, this LIGO window, and so then the question follows, which was being asked, which is, why do we imagine that these are in thermal equilibrium, and the picture that we have in mind is analogous to a mode re-entering the horizon in cosmology. So if I start with a nearly homogeneous matter distribution on cosmological scales, and I imagine that we're in a de Sitter phase, so that this distribution is expanding, but that it has some density fluctuations in it. Then what can happen is I have a density fluctuation which is super the Hubble horizon, and as the evolution proceeds, it comes within the Hubble horizon. And when that happens, you can have a critical distribution of matter, and it forms a trapping surface. I've never heard of this picture before. This is something that Eugenio and I came up with, but it has a couple of really nice features. Which is that you might worry, okay, the QCD phase transition is interesting, but the QCD phase transition lasts for some short amount of time. So if you have a stellar collapse and it takes a long time, you might worry that you're outside of the QCD phase transition before the black hole is formed. Like if it was as fast as the light crossing time of the black hole, you might really worry. But in this model, you don't have that problem, because the mode is re-entering the Hubble horizon, and the trapping surface forms as soon as that happens. It's almost instantaneous. So you really can form these right at the phase transition. The second nice feature of this picture is that you could also ask. So we have this density fluctuation, right? So we have an overdensity, but that overdensity is effectively outside of causal contact because it's beyond its own Hubble horizon.
Because it's before.
Yeah, because of the cosmological evolution, right? This perturbation is outside of the current Hubble horizon. And then as the Hubble horizon, as the effective length scale of the mode changes, it comes inside the Hubble horizon, and you have an overdensity that's sufficient to have a trapping surface. So right as the mode crosses its Hubble horizon, it forms a trapping surface, which is a black hole.
So what's the relationship at that time with the time of the phase transition?
I'm sorry if I confused you. My only concern was that if you had stellar collapse, right? Stellar collapse takes some time, right? And so I was worried about the time scale of the phase transition.
Yes.
If you had a stellar collapse model, right? Then the stellar collapse might be longer. For example, it might be a light crossing time of.
In our case, all you need
is the mode to re-enter, right?
The mode which means
the overdensity, right? This density fluctuation. All it needs to do is re-enter, and you immediately form a trapping surface. So there's no worry about time scale there.
But it's a yearly phase transition, then after, because it re-enters after the phase transition.
No, it's re-entering as the phase transition is happening. So you have So you have a coincidence of the drop in pressure.
That's a small time window.
Yes, that's a small time window, but it's fine.
You need to have a coincidence of it.
Exactly.
When is that?
In what sense?
Where that the phase transition was re-entering the.
Well, it's at the QCD phase transition, so it's a microsecond after the Big Bang, if you believe me. So the second feature of this model that I think is really beautiful is that the matter distribution that you have is already in thermal equilibrium. So the hypothesis is not an extreme hypothesis at all. It's not that there's some crazy interaction that's happening. You start out with a matter distribution that's in thermal equilibrium. Then you form this trapping surface. And OK, we can't model a highly dense matter distribution on cosmological scales very effectively analytically yet. But whatever the entropy of that matter distribution is, it should coincide with the entropy of the black hole when this trapping surface forms. So the assumption is a very mild assumption, which is that the thermal equilibrium of the matter distribution continues to the thermal equilibrium of the black hole. That's the assumption that we're putting into it. And then finally, the last nice feature of this way of thinking of things is that you also have a mechanism after this black hole forms in thermal equilibrium, you have a mechanism for it to remain isolated, which is that you're in this de Sitter expansion phase. So the environment around the trapping surface just keeps expanding, and it rarefies the environment of the black hole. So you have a good reason for it to form with zero spin and to stay at zero spin.
What do you mean you're long after inflation and before dark matter dominance? So at this point, your radiation dominant.
No, we're thinking of this as being being still during an inflationary-like phase, at least in this region.
So then, you can do that because during inflation, the perturbation is being pushed outside the horizon.
So
the QCD phase transition must be happening long after inflation.
Yeah, no, you're right. I misspoke.
So I think Lee is right. During radiation era, unless you're arguing to still correct.
Because the mode is re-entering.
The environment, so you don't need it to be.
Yeah, it's just an expansion. Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Good. So this is the answer to Laurent's question that came very first in the talk. What is a picture of a black hole that forms in thermal equilibrium? So this is our answer to that question. So let me quickly summarize.
So could I question you on that answer? Your black hole is forming from a gas, which is in thermal equilibrium itself. But when you talk about the microcanonical ensemble of black holes, I think you're implying that the black holes are somehow in equilibrium because they are able to exchange spin or other properties. I think these are two different things. You've just argued.
I think I disagree with that.
Isolated black holes from thermal gas. I haven't heard you argue.
I disagree with the claim that this is about a population that's in equilibrium with itself. It's not about black holes interacting with black holes.
So
it's about
inheriting the equilibrium from the original matter.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's about.
That's
okay. So in summary. We've introduced this black hole spin ensemble. The assumptions that go into it is that the black hole entropy is relevant for counting the number of microstates, and that you can speak about a microcanonical population. So this is this discussion we were just having. So this black hole spin ensemble leads to these conditional probabilities that are highly peaked at zero spin. And this distribution is truly distinguishable from aligned and isotropic models. And so as we enter this era of population statistics for gravitational wave measurements, we really have hope of distinguishing a population of microcanonical black holes, even if it's a small fraction of the total gravitational wave measurements. So as I started out saying, I'm really excited about this as a phenomenological probe of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. I don't know of any others. And I think it's really interesting that it's robust to your favorite model of quantum gravity. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your nice talk. And we still have some time for questions.
You were talking about any other tests of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. I was just remembering there's this paper by Klebin and Hoy. Recently, they do not talk about this statistical ensemble that you talked about, but I think they're agnostic to the formation mechanism. But they do talk about how to the alpha parameter, when you write the
states.
Yeah, so they talk about how to just use gravitational wave and like observations to test for the alpha using two different observations.
Good. I don't know that paper.
Look it up, yeah.
So this is right off the top, but if we did live in a universe that was created from a balance, and if it was maybe a history of balances, then astrophysical black holes have an opportunity to get thermalized during the balances when the And is it possible that would explain the
Yeah, so I don't see why you couldn't have a totally different mechanism. So you thermalize via a bounce. You still have the same thing to do that we have not yet done, which is here I argued that you maintain that thermal equilibrium in the short term, right, near the formation, just through dilution of the environment surrounding the black hole. But one thing we have not done is really argue that over the entire history of evolution from formation to present day, you can also maintain that spin. So that's something that's to be done.
It's from there being relatively isolated.
Yeah. So that's the main argument. It appears the LIGO measurements are pointing towards these binaries mostly being in the halos of dwarf galaxies, which are pretty rare environments. So that would be the hope that you could argue that they remain relatively isolated.
So they're in the halos of dwarf galaxies.
That's the indication.
But that's not a place where we expect to see a lot of massive stars because there aren't giant like balance and everything. Making catalyzed. star formation and therefore black hole formation.
That's right.
So that's a really weird place to be seen.
It's interesting.
Any further questions? If that's not the case, let's thank Alan again.